Hello, I'm Priya Bates, President of Inner Strength Communication based in Toronto, Canada.
And I'm Adwita Patel, Director of Comms Rebel based in Manchester, UK.
And we're co-founders of A Leader Like Me.
We've also recently published a book with Kogan Page called Building a Culture of Inclusivity: Effective Internal Communication for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion.
In season three of our podcast, we will introduce you to diverse voices where we talk about the role of communication personally and professionally in building inclusive cultures.
We hope you enjoy our podcast.
Today, we are so thrilled to host the three co-authors of the Global Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Benchmarks. Julie O'Mara is co-founder of GDEIB, along with Alan Richter. She is also president of O'Mara and Associates, an organization development consulting firm. She specialized in leadership and managing diversity and inclusion and is considered a pioneer for her work. In fact, she has received several awards, including being named to the Economist Global Diversity List 2015, a Diversity Legacy Leader by the Forum on Workplace Inclusion, Pioneer of Diversity by the Diversity Journal, and the ASTD Women's Network Professional Leadership Development Award. Next, founder and president of QED Consulting, Alan Richter, has consulted to organizations for over 32 years in multiple capacities, specializing in the areas of global leadership, ethics and values, diversity and inclusion, culture and change. He is the author of the award-winning Global Diversity Game and the co-author of the Global Diversity Survey, as well as the Global Leadership Survey and the Global Gender Intelligence Assessment. In addition to the GDIB, he has also co-authored the Global Ethics and Integrity Benchmarks. Nini Malefi is the president and owner of Mandate Malefi HR Consultants. She is an experienced consultant with a track record that spans over 22 years. She was born in Soweto, South Africa. Her work involves consulting and facilitation in whole system culture change, transformation, diversity, equity, inclusion, and values-driven leadership interventions for large and medium-sized organizations. Nini is an international speaker with a creative storytelling approach to sharing complex issues of South Africa's journey to democracy, helping participants navigate the difficult terrain of race and intersectionality in society and in their workplace. We are so excited today to have Julie O'Mara, Alan Richter, and Nina Malefi with us to talk about the Center of Global Inclusion and the GDEIB standards. And GDEIB stands for the Global Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Benchmarks, which is a plethora of resources, research, and tools that amazingly is available for free to people who want to use it to improve DEI and culture in their organizations. So I'm so excited, first of all, to have all of you here at the same time. I can't believe with all the time zones that we managed to do that. So thank you, Julie, for working on getting everyone here. But let's start. I want to take us back because what I learned, and we included information on the GDEIB in our book, which is Building a Culture of Inclusivity. I learned that you started working on the standard and the work in the space in 2005, and that in 2006, you created GDIB, which is the Global Diversity and Inclusion Benchmark. And I want to know a little bit, because it was Julie and Alan who started out, what was it that encouraged you to partner? And why did you believe there was a need for the benchmarks? I don't know who wants to start first.
Let me go first because there's history behind that before we got to 2005. And it really all started in the 1990s when I think Julie and I separately, unbeknownst to one another, were probably doing consulting around diversity. And the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA, which builds dams, by the way, a government agency, put together a research department and created a document called Benchmarks for Diversity. And it was the first attempt to look at what best practices were in the area. It was a wonderful piece of work published in 1993. So we're going back 30 years now. It only talked about diversity. There was nothing global about it. There was nothing about inclusion about it specifically. It was very much, coming out of the affirmative action world and putting together something around diversity. It was useful, but it was never updated. So they put one thing out, and then over, you know, the next 5-10 years, as the field was really progressing, you know, very fast, nothing was updated, and it was never beyond a US audience. I remember taking the document to the World Health Organization in the early 2000s, and they just laughed at it. This is so American, forget it. You know, we don't want to use this. And that's what prompted me to think about how do we go global with this thing. And Julia and I, of course, had known one another from the field, and we were part of something called the Collegium. And we decided we'd take it on, and we got permission from the TBA that we could use their materials as a start, you know, without any problem. They said, given it was government research, it's freely available, will you keep your document free? And we had a discussion about it. We're both in the consulting world, but we felt, yeah, let's make that free. And we brought on about 40, I think it was 47 consultants in the diversity field to help us. They were the first batch of expert panelists. So that's how we got going. In 2006 was the first edition of the GDIB, and then there have been three editions further, and I'm sure Julie wants to say a lot more about those.
I want to go back a little bit, because it was kind of funny, because Alan and I were sitting next to us at a meeting, and we were having this conversation at the meeting about how people really didn't know what good work looked like in terms of DEI, you know. And I remember this is, you know, like 2005, but I still think this might be part of an issue today. But a lot of people think that, you know, good work looks like, you know, having employee resource groups, ERGs or whatever you call them, or cooking ethnic food in the cafeteria, or having pictures of, you know, as you say in Canada, racialized people, you know, in the lobby, that sort of thing. And both Alan and I work at a systems change level. So the GDEIB is really for systems change, not systematic, but systems. So you look at way beyond behavior, but what kind of change does the organization need to be? And I have a background in OD and was working on some big organizational change projects related to DEI at that time. So and it was funny because I can picture that conversation, and we were saying, oh, my, people really don't know what good work looks like. And this was a vehicle to really put it out. And so, as Alan said, we made a lot of changes in it, and then we made a lot of changes over the years. So we also made a commitment to update it every 5 years, if needed, because the field changes. I mean, this is still a very young field, and it's very large. I mean, now you you know, listen to webinars, and everybody uses all kinds of different initials to describe what it is. I mean, we've stuck with diversity, equity, and inclusion, but it's, I mean, it's really growing very much in that. So that's how we started, you know. And then, I mean, our goal is really to help people do effective, high quality diversity, equity, and inclusion work that could be measured and that changes not only the individual, but the organization's systems.
Brilliant. You mentioned that you've done quite a few updates to the GD, initially what was GDIB, Then recently you've added equity to make it GDEIB. Why was it so important to add that equity part to the initial framework and the benchmark?
Somebody
else?
Yeah.
Well, I think, but firstly, maybe because that's missing as to how I come into the equation. So I was a member of the Diversity Collegium for quite a while also. And then I was invited by Julie and Alan to be one of the co-authors of the latest version. But I had been an expert panelist before that. So when we did the 2021 version, the need to include the E as part of GDEIB was just screaming at us, because talking about diversity and inclusion and ignoring the equity part, it's almost like doing half a job, because it's one thing you can be as diverse as the rainbow, if you like, you know, and you have to ensure that, yes, you are inclusive, but equitable practices are important. How to ensure that there's equity and the measures that are needed, that organizations need to do to ensure that while you are working towards inclusion, you are doing that in an equitable way. That is why there's even a difference between equality and equity. So we had a lot of debates, conversations, and we just had to include the E in the process, because if it's missing, then, as I said, you haven't really covered. And in it happens. Okay, maybe this is where also other parts of the world come in. It happens to be such an emotive issue in South Africa, the E part of it. People are happy if you're saying, let's include everybody. But the minute you're saying, let's ensure that you put in place equitable measures, that's where the difficulty come in. So we had to face it and say, it will be diversity, equity, and inclusion. You will notice that other people call it diversity, equity, and inclusion, belonging. Others add the J in terms of justice. It was just becoming wrong. So for us, the most important part was to say GDEIB. At least we've covered the most critical elements of that.
Now,
if I could just add two things, because there were global drivers that also between 2016 and 2021 that pushed this. One was Black Lives Matter. I mean, that had a huge impact, not just in the US, but globally around equity. And the other was the Me Too movement, which preceded that, you know, the whole gender inequality piece. So those were two very powerful global drivers that I think helped take us from GDIB to GDEIB. And just to go back one step, you know, 2006, 2011, there wasn't much change except for the design. We actually came up with the four groups, which was important to understand diversity as foundational, internal, external, and bridging. 2016, the big impetus there was the Sustainable Development Goals from the UN. And that's where the whole notion of sustainability played into. We had a whole new category. We talked a lot about sustainability. But then the big shift was 2016, 2021, adding E not only in the title, but also in many of the benchmarks, the actual benchmarks themselves. So that brings us up to the present, so to speak. Yeah.
And there's one more thing, too. The whole pandemic and the different way that people are working changed something. And it's not like we didn't have equity in the beginning, because we had a lot of equity and social justice, but we really saw this shift in the field moving more from the business case and those kind of hard measures around business case to including behaviors, more social justice, and that sort of thing. So we really upped the ante about the focus on equity, and we then included it in the title.
I just wanted to ask this question about decision that you made to include equity over equality, because one of the debates I often face into with certain leaders in organizations is, surely we have to be equal and because that's fair rather than equitable, which can sometimes come across as unfair, which is really interesting, and we do often get into some debate. So it'll be really interesting to get your perspective on the equitable side of things over equality and why you made that intentional choice for equity over equality.
I think the most important thing, firstly, to, and those are the debates I normally enjoy when I do with yes, we want equality, but the world is not equal. Mm-hmm. For us to get to equality, you need to go through equitable practices to say, how do we ensure that, I know back in the years of affirmative action, people were talking about leveling the playing field, whatever, even if we were to use different words. But yes, ultimately, we want equality. But in order to get to equality, because equality, you're treating everybody the same. If you do that without recognizing the inequities that are there, you are actually virtually treating everybody unequally. So it's a process that you have to go through in order for you to reach the state of equality.
One of the things that I was so amazed with when I was researching the benchmarks and the process that you used was the fact that you brought in almost 50 leaders from around the world to contribute to what best practice looks like. And recently, I think in your last set, it was 150? 112. It was over 100 who really spanned the globe and spanned, mm-hmm. like was really the gamut of expertise, so that you could say, let's really think about what this looks like globally in terms of best practices. And that's something that's often forgotten. Like Evita and I do a lot of work on values and strategies, and it's the same people mm-hmm. around the table in the room with the same perspectives and the same experiences making the decisions. I want you to talk to me about the thinking behind bringing those groups together, and where did that really work, and where did you see some of the where did you recognize the challenges that were challenging you to get through the work as well?
Okay, well, let me start on that, and then the two of you can come in on that. In terms of the expert panelists, and we do spend a lot of effort with the expert panelists, and they're volunteers, and they don't just like check the box and say, "Oh, this looks wonderful." They really work hard. So, and they're we need 112 or thereabouts because there's so many dimensions of diversity, like race and gender, et cetera. And then we have a lot of people who work internally, and then people who are consultants, small firms, large firms. And then we do have somebody from every major region of the world. And we try to, we don't try to make it even because there's so much intersectionality. You know, there's, so you really can't do like a matrix, you know, that defines who the expert panelists are. But there's a wide variety of people. And in terms of working with them, I guess what I've found is that there's more similarity about how diversity work is being done around the world. Gender right now is, of course, the biggest, the most emphasis on gender as a dimension right now. But it seems very similar, but there's just enough difference, you know, in wording, like you mentioned, equality versus equity. We do find a difference by region of the world in terms of what word is chosen. Like, for instance, in the UK, you use the word equality a lot because that's what your legislation calls it. In other places, it's equity. So in Canada and in the U.S., it's equity. And in other, and in South Africa, it's equity as well, I believe. Right, Nini? Yeah. So anyway, I mean, that's part of the background on this. And then somebody else want to take the rest of it?
Sure. Nini, you want to go next or I'll go? You're still muted. Okay, I'll go next then. I probably have had the privilege of growing up in South Africa, living in England, and then living in the US. I've had three different homes. It's all Anglo in sense of the language. I mean, that's the unearned privilege, which is a huge privilege of having English as a mother tongue. But I'm always been very interested in global perspectives. Where we've worked, my QED, my company, we've worked in over 80 countries. So I'm very, very sensitive to cultural differences around the world. And this isn't anything to do with the GDEIB, but I can mention that in 2015, I was the co-editor of a book called An Inquiry into the Existence of Global Values. And the subtitle was Through the Lens of Comparative Constitutional Law. I'm not a lawyer. I was the only non-lawyer on the project. But we looked at constitutions in 15 countries. We're talking about Japan, China, India, Australia, Iran, Israel, South Africa, Finland, Germany, France, Britain, Canada, the US, Venezuela, and Brazil. I mean, really cultural diversity big time. The only big country missing, I think, was Russia. And we just, the author disappeared on us. That's another story altogether. But the point is, we were looking at what are the ingrained values in each constitution. And, you know, we were looking for both the similarities. Was there anything truly global across all these cultures? And then where were the big differences? The big differences all over the place, even in the very definitions. But the one finding we did get, which I still quote all the time, is that there were three values that were across all 15 constitutions of the countries. I call them the three Fs. It was freedom, family, and fairness. Now, how you define fairness, you know, equality, equity, that's another whole story. And is it individual? Is it group? But those three values tended to be pretty universal. And that's the good news, that we could have a universal declaration of human rights because there are some shared values. How countries prioritize those values, how cultures prioritize, very, very different. And that's where we get into all the sort of ethical dilemmas in the field because of different prioritizations. So,
for what it's worth. If I were to add that, you know, about, I think it was 3 days ago, I was talking to someone about GDIB, that this tool, we are very clear that this is not, you cannot argue that this is this empirical science tool where you do statistical analysis. We are very clear that this is a tool where we approach it from consensus, right? One of the reasons that are important that we mentioned this, we formed subgroups. So the 112 expert panelists were really formed into different groups where we took each of the topics and people were categorized according to areas of their expertise and all that. Because if you were to take a tool that has a 5-point Likert scale to say 3 says this, 5 says this, it's different from when somebody says, yeah, this might be what a scientific tool says, but in my country, this is my experience. In somebody else's country, this is my experience. So there's a lot of value. We found a lot of value in ensuring that teams of people who are experts in their various regions get together to actually explain, first of all, to each other how, like, if you look at our model, if you look at the blue is really on all the internal benchmarks. You look at recruitment, advancement, compensation, and benefits. If you look at the, every country would approach them differently. So the value of having people who are placed all over the world is that they are enriching the tool. It's actually much more enriched by the 112 people giving their perspectives on how they have seen it work, because most of them were also, it's a combination of consultants and practitioners, but it's people who are coming with their lived experience on what these benchmarks mean.
You know, and the other thing I wanted to add too is that you know, I don't know if you've ever done this, but the word herding cats, I think that's a fairly global word. It's certainly a global behavior. But, you know, people have so many different viewpoints, you know, that they come together. And, you know, we really worked hard to achieve consensus. But there's so many different viewpoints that, you know, we finally get to a point where there's a lot of agreement, but it's hard work, you know, on our part as the authors, because there's a lot of discussion, there's, you know, the dialogue, debate, you know, and that, so there's a lot of dialogue, a lot of debate, and a lot of surprises, I think, as they talk. The other thing that I really wanted to mention is that our definition of global. So sometimes in the profession, people think when we're saying global, that this tool is only for like multinational big organizations, and it's not. It's really, you know, our second, you know, after, there's a colon after global diversity and inclusion benchmarks, and it's a standards for organizations around the world. So any size, any industry, any type of organization really can use the benchmarks.
And one of the great things about your benchmarks is that the resources are free. And when we interviewed Zahid, who's the HR consultant from Pakistan on one of the previous episodes, he said that the GDEIB is the world's greatest secret. As Priya said just offline before we came to do this recording, that what the work you have done is incredible and it's so detailed and informative. Why do you think it is the world's greatest secret? You know, like I said, the resources are free, it's accessible, it's great, it's clear. But what do you think is some of the challenges facing people to get involved in some of the work that you're doing?
Well, it's just difficult, yeah, to get the word out. I mean, it just, you know, and I mean, it just takes a lot of effort. So One thing that always, you know, surprises me is, you know, how much money and how many donations and that it takes to give something away for free, You know, because all of that, you know, answering and inquiries and all this kind of activity that we do costs something. So it does take a lot of effort. Now, I mean, we've had some wonderful sponsors, you know, that have really helped us a lot. And, you know, so that spreads the word. And it's also not for beginners necessarily. I mean, it might be for a beginner in terms of like reading and looking at how broad this field is, but you have to have a pretty good, strong commitment that you really want to do effective work. You want to do more than just check that box. And we think that there's still a lot of organizations out there that want to check the box. So they look at the GDEIB and they go, oh, my goodness, there's so much here. And I mean, I don't know, Alan and Nini, what you think, but I think that's a big part of it, you know, but it's deep.
I think for me, I wanted to say the greatness of this tool. One of the clients once said that unlike whether you use it as a consultant in an organization or you are a practitioner within an organization, what this tool really helps is that I would come and you would do your own assessment, whether an organization is inactive or their best practice, because it has all those five stages. But what has been good is that you're not just saying, okay, you are at three or you are inactive. It will then, you leave the tool with them. They are able to see that in order for us to be best practice, what is it that we can do? Even if they're not there yet, they already have something in their hands that says, in order to be best practice, you can look at number five. These are the things that we can put in place. So for me, that's a very useful tool, as opposed to just coming and doing a survey or an assessment and saying, you're not good, or you are number three out of five. And then so what? So the so what part of is in the tool itself, which is why I think it's very good and people appreciate it.
So if I can just add to that, I mean, the value of the tool, I think, is longitudinal. So once you do an assessment, you get what we call a baseline score, and then you can measure progress over time. The other important thing to recognize here is that we are not benchmarking. We're benchmarking, any organization can then use the tool to benchmark against what we're calling global best practice level five. It's not a benchmark within one's industry or within one's country. We don't have that data. Now, the last thing I want to make is that we as authors, we want to develop two things, or we want others to help, you know, develop, and we'll be part of it, a certification for the tool. So there's some sort of structure here, but also a digital version, because once we get the digital version up and running, or whoever does, the opportunities for that no longer to be a secret can multiply, you know, tenfold, hundredfold. And down the road, once you've got a database, it's all about going digital here. Once you've got a database, then you can start to benchmark not only against global best practice, but if I'm a mid-sized American pharmaceutical, I can measure my company against other mid-sized companies, other American companies, other pharmaceutical companies. But you've got to build up that database, and yeah, you know, that will take quite a bit of time.
Yeah. Absolutely. Evita and I, as part of our book, had launched a quick assessment. So we've kind of said, we've got the DEI evolution from where it exists, which is where we are. We don't want to make any changes, to embed, which is, this is every day. And it's been interesting that the fall off rate when they're answering the assessment is they stop answering it in the middle. Because as soon as they realize that they're answering questions and they haven't done enough, it's almost as if they're afraid to continue, which has been a little mind-blowing to us, right? We always thought, well, you want to know where you are. Acknowledgement is the first step in order to improve, that you need to know exactly where you sit right now. But there seems to be a fear out there. Have you guys experienced that as well?
Well, I would answer that in terms of we've had thousands of downloads of the benchmarks, thousands upon thousands, certainly over the four versions of it. How many people just download it and then it sits in a file and never gets used? We don't know. We don't know the numbers, but there are many who probably say, oh, this is too overwhelming for me, you know, and they don't use it. On the other hand, we keep coming across so many companies and organizations, unbeknownst to us. Oh, yeah, we've been using it for 5 years. You know, we're delighted, you know, that the word has got out. So I don't know how much of a secret it still is. Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah, there's really quite a lot of people who are using it. I shouldn't say people, I should say organizations, because it's an organization change tool. It's not an individual change tool. You know, so this is not something that you give to everybody in your organization. You give it to people who kind of know certain categories and what's really going on, so that people can say, yes, that's good or that's bad, rather than, I don't know. You know, so that makes a big difference. It's organization change that we're looking at, and organization effectiveness on a systems basis.
And in a way, I can understand an organization that stops in the middle because of fear, because often what I've seen is people who have been telling themselves they are so good with GDI. And then when they see there are so many things that, what, even this is DEI? I didn't. So I think it's more like, it's not like they're paralyzed by it, but it's more like a shock of how much work still lies ahead. So it's a good type of stress to say to them, there's a lot of work ahead of you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was funny, you all couldn't see this, but Nini's eyes looked like, the as she was describing that, the deer in the headlights, you know, like, oh my goodness, you know, there is really a lot to DEI. We have 15 categories, you know, so, and both internal, I mean, communications is one. I personally, because of my background, I don't forget this, and that, you know, I, communication is like my favorite one, because I do think that that is, that communication is the glue that helps keep all together. And a lot of times people really don't know what the organization is doing in terms of DEI. They don't know about the benefits. They just don't have the information. So just to me, communications is really important. I guess it's not only the telling part of it, but the asking people, you know, what they want and what they know and that sort of thing. So to me, it's a very important category. We've never, like, you know, prioritized our categories or anything like that. So I'm being a little facetious by saying it's my favorite one. And I promise you, I'm not just trying to appeal to your audience, but it really is an important category, communications.
Yeah. I mean, we have the bias, and we'll agree with you there, Julie. We've written a whole book about how communication professionals need to step up into this space and drive some of this agenda. You know, the work that we've witnessed in the organizations that we support, sometimes it's done in isolation, and sometimes it's led by one person who has the desire to make change happen. And communications, to your point, can play a big part in making sure that the understanding across the entire spectrum of the organization is there, from the leadership team all the way down to the people who may be on the front line. And that's really critical. And that's the gap that Priya and I saw when we were first of all getting involved in this work, that there just wasn't any alignment between what the communications team were doing and what the HR and DEI professionals and leaders were doing. And they were kind of working in their own isolated space, and then conflict started. So I think the fact that you've got comms as such an important part of your benchmark and framework is really important and critical. You mentioned that, you know, you've had thousands of downloads, and you've also come across some organizations that have used it. Do you have any, are you able to share any companies or organizations that are using it and the impact it's had on that company over the, you know, over the 5-10 years that they may have been implementing the strategies and advice that you shared?
Well, we have like a confidentiality rule, so we don't really share a lot of information about individual organizations without asking their direct, without asking them directly for this podcast. Yeah. But we've had a newsletter in the past. We're going to start it up again, I hope. And that tells stories of organizations that, you know, that have really used the GDEIB. And it's about a 3-year journey. You know, I mean, you mentioned Zahid in Pakistan, and so he gives some annual awards. He's been doing it for about 4 or 5 years. And so there's many organizations in Pakistan, in the banking industry, and in other industries. I can't remember right now, but I know banking or financial services is a very strong industry that a lot of them have made big changes, and a lot of different programs with the GDEIB, like a communications program or outreach into the community. That is another one that a lot of organizations work with. And then what they find when they do outreach in the community is that that comes back to them in, you know, higher employment statistics. Like, you know, it's easier for them to hire quality people when that when the community feels like they're really helping the community. And participating in a lot of volunteerism and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Alan or Nini, you have more on that?
Yeah, also in the PDF version as well of the GDIB, somewhere in the beginning there are some practitioners who have quotes, and they've written the names of their companies or organizations, that this is how, what it has done for me, this is what So at least those would give you some kind of picture as to who have volunteered to give us information that it has had a good impact for them.
There's about 20.
Yeah, I can mention that it crosses all the sort of industry, you know, from banking and finance to utilities to research organizations to educational organizations. Just a couple of examples that are public in the sense. One, I guess, would be the CFA Institute, which does certify financial advisors. Now, this is in the previous edition before 2021, before the pandemic, using the 2016 edition. They brought about 200 of their members, these are investment banks all over North America, into meetings in New York and Chicago and Toronto and you know, different places around the country. And they did use the benchmarks to actually score, you know, where were these companies, you know, on, I think they didn't know all the categories, but at least, you know, I can't remember, it was eight or nine categories. And then they, you know, aggregated it all and they came up with that. And they wrote a report, you know, and the report was kind of quite telling because if you aggregated all the scores together, you know, the industry was at a 2.3 or something, which is between, you know, reactive and proactive. They weren't even proactive yet, although there were some companies that were, but many, the majority weren't, you know. So the industry had a ton more work to do, but this created a sort of baseline for the financial services industry, you know. I can give you many kinds of examples like that.
But let me give one more that's a very small organization. So they only have about 25 employees, and it's an independent, very well-known, very successful publishing company. But the publishing company, one of the things that they worked on, and this has to do with like marketing and products and that sort of thing, is that they have about 1,000 authors. And so one of the things that they worked on doing was influencing their authors, even just in stuff like the language that you use. And when you give examples, don't just do Anglo names. You know, let's put some variety. And then also, one of the things that Western organizations can be known for is making assumptions that are white dominated or Western culture dominated. And if you're an editor of a book and you're working with all your authors, you can edit that out. And so it's really important to, well, publishing is like communications. So you know the influence that you can have just in terms of the wording that you use and many, many opportunities to substitute some kind of a global example for a Western culture example. And so so it's been very successful in terms of that publishing company over the years to see the changes in the books. And also one of the things that thrills me is to just see the number of diversity, equity, and inclusion books that they're publishing now because they know more about it.
You know, we could probably spend 5 hours talking about the benchmarks themselves, which we don't have time to do, because we want to encourage everyone to go in and download the benchmarks and learn about your process. What I was really impressed with when I was looking at the benchmarks was, you know, the four groups and the 15 categories that you score yourself against. It's a really great process. It's really easy to understand. It's really as easy to say, yes, we're doing this. No, we are not. I love the fact that you started with foundation, right? The vision, the strategy, leadership, DEI structure, all of those foundational things that even when we're out there working with communication professionals and organizations, we always say, what are the values? What's the strategy? We need to start with those foundations. You then looked at internal, which is the kind of the recruitment, retention, advancement, compensation, benefits, like how an organization functions, which you have standards against that. Then you talk about bridging, which is my favorite part, which is the communication and learning and development. It's the connections that need to be formed. Yeah. And then it's external, because all those things then impact community and government relations, the conversations around ESG, service and product development, marketing and customer service, and how you source. Like, it is really holistic. This is a business tool. This is not a DEI tool.
True.
This is a business tool. So how difficult was it to first of all create, like, hone in on the categories and bringing that together? Like, what was the thinking behind that?
Well, it evolved over time. That's why, you know, when you go back to the original, you know, TVA thing, I think they had 20 categories, but they were in no order. There were no groups. You know, that was the big breakthrough for us to come out with the four groups. And then we've rearranged things within the groups, moved things around over time. The four groups make a lot of sense. I'll just share with you, as a result of the success of the GDEIB, this is back in 2008-09, because I do a lot of work in the ethics field, we developed a parallel document called the Global Ethics and Integrity Benchmarks. And we were working on the model for that, you know, having done the work already on the diversity, equity, or inclusion one. So we came up with a model of a house, you know, because in ethics, you need a foundation. So that's the same as the diversity one. But then the house itself is really the culture. Do we have an ethical culture? You know, and then the roof is ethical risk, because a lot of the work around ethics is dealing with corruption and conflicts of interest and blah, 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 blah. So we used a very similar thinking, but came up with a different, slightly different model for the ethics benchmarks. And that's also, by the way, free and downloadable, and thousands and thousands of downloads of that one. We don't track that one, by the way. That's another story.
this is not controversial, but it's definitely a topic at the moment that I'm hearing, and Priya is as well, around, is the light dimming on diversity, equity, and inclusion? Are people now tired, is the word that was used to me not so long ago, about hearing about inclusion and equity? And are we in danger, is another word that was shared with me, in going too far with this work? I'm curious and interested to hear your point of view on if that is something that you're hearing globally, or just pockets of information. And do you think the light is dimming, and we need to, and compared to where we were 3 years ago, when Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement was driving some of this agenda?
I'm very keen to hear Nini's perspective.
Yeah, I definitely don't think the light is dimming. What I think is happening is that movements, let me call it a movement, like the anti-woke movement that we hear a lot, the anti-cancel culture, whatever words that are being used, is gaining momentum. And that movement is giving a voice to people who were resisting anyway at the DEI journey. So once they found a window opening a little bit to say, yes, now people have gone to the other side of the pendulum, right? We were talking about DEI. Now, I mean, the other day on our TV here, there was a whole debate around in a school that one of the children came to school and he says he now identifies as a wolf, right? And he can go around like an animal around. It was a huge debate. And the parents were saying, yes, it's because of this DEI thing. But when you listen carefully, it's all the people who are resisting anyway. You know, I've seen that in this work. There's a bell curve that I always see. In the beginning, you find a smaller number of early adopters, people who, when you talk about it, they say, it makes sense. I want to be in, I want to go through. And then in the middle, a bigger chunk of the wait and see, people who are saying, I want to know more. And then the last part of the curve, you know, if I describe how the corporate world in South Africa is, the last part of the curve is the resistors, right? Those who you will bang your head against the wall, they will still not be willing to go through that journey. And I find that the anti-woke movement comes from that right-hand side. And they are finding a lot of sympathy because they are dramatizing the whole thing, that it means everything that we ever believed in. I mean, I'm a Christian myself, but you sometimes hear people talking about Christianity and I say, I don't think that's true. And, you know, so I don't think the light is dimming. I think people are realizing that we still have to do work on this, and they are looking for ways in which they could discount the good work that is happening. But definitely a movement, the anti-woke movement, are there. They are trying to do their work every day.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that's the whole political thing that we're in, sadly. And we've seen, you know, after 4 years of Trump, you know, this stuff has come out, and, you know, but I think the alternative to that is to sort of look at all the thriving aspects of diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a group, the IAC, what does it stand for? The Inclusion Allies Coalition. you know, right. is very much pushing that message. And it's very important to push it, especially in states in this country that have gone just, you know, off the wall. I mean, I don't want to sound political, but the grand old party is now the gone overboard party. And that's it. You know, there's no logic any longer, you know, to the in this anti-woke stuff. It's just, yeah, that's so. Yes, politics is in the way. It'll work its way out, I hope. Otherwise, we're in real trouble.
You know, I mentioned that my background is in organization development. And one of the things that we say in the OD world about resistance is that when you begin to get, or when you get a lot of resistance, that's when you know you're being successful. Because now people think that you're enough of a factor to really resist strongly. And I think that's what's happening. And this is not a US or North American thing at all. This is a global thing. And I think it was very interesting when, you know, when George Floyd was killed, that that went around the world, and that inspired a lot of people to push back. And, you know, then the way we are as human beings, you know, that fades after a while, but it's coming back in this, as Nini, you know, so eloquently said about, you know, the woke movement and all that. I think this is a major societal change that's going to take us longer than we thought it would. I remember I was part of a group a long time ago that we talked about in our lifetime. That was our goal around DEI work, in our lifetime. I think it's going to be longer than that, at least in my lifetime. Maybe somebody else's lifetime will make more change. But in my lifetime, I think we're not going to be done. You know, maybe we'll never be done. But anyway, with all of your listeners out there helping, then that's what we need.
And I think go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, you can look at objective data that shows the movement in the right direction. I mean, if you take something like LGBTQ, you know, 22 years ago, no country on the planet allowed for same-sex marriage. There's now over 30 of them. So in 22 years, you know, tremendous growth in acceptance and inclusion around sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. If you look at something like disability, you know, accessibility around the world, thanks to technology, and, you know, has improved immensely, you know, in many, many countries. Still a long way to go. I mean, by no means have we reached the level of, you know, of equality, which is where we want to get to. But we can see, you know, behind all this rhetoric and nonsense around anti-woke, there are strides forward. And yes, there's a couple of steps back, but generally speaking, I think we're moving in the right direction. Yeah.
Well, I love that. If I add what I'm spending increasingly most of my time in the workshops is also to educate what I would call the marginalized groups, because it doesn't mean when you are from the marginalized group, you're always right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because mm-hmm. what is happening in the workshops is that, let me just take a gender identity or LGBTQI as an example. You know, the other day, one of my workshops, I was saying the way you challenge people, somebody joined on Zoom. I was doing a workshop on Zoom. Somebody joined on Zoom and they didn't write their pronouns, right? So the way the other person challenged them, it was in such a disrespectful, demeaning, where's your pronoun? And I said, there is no way anybody will tolerate that type of a tone. So even if I'm from a marginalized a community or marginalized group and my rights have been trampled on over many years, I still have a responsibility as to how I show up in this conversation. So I also find that we educate those who are the resistors, but we also educate those who feel that it's my time, it's my right. That if you want a dialogue that makes sense, you need to show up in a way that somebody would want to listen to you, not walk away from a workshop. So I'm spending a lot of my time there as well.
I love that, Nini. I think I'm hearing a lot of great themes that we can end on. First of all, I love, Julie, you talking about the fact that the resistance means that things are working. You know, that's so great. I love that, thinking about it that way. Alan, I love the fact that you're looking at the data and saying, we have made so much progress. You know, we always say too slow for some, too fast for others, but right. We are moving in the right direction. And then I love Nina, Nini, the fact that you said that we all have a role to play, that in order to drive inclusion, we all need to show up in order. And we also need to lead with hope versus fear, that we have this intention and goals to create a world that we want, where all of us can belong, where we all are included, where we all can show up at our best. And that's what we're all striving for, right? In all our, in our HR leader roles, in our leadership roles, in our communication roles, in our business roles, we want to create something incredible using all the brilliant minds that are part of this. And this has been such a great conversation. We weren't sure, having five people in this conversation, how well it would work, but we, I think everybody, you know, was respectful. Everyone, you know, had a chance to speak and share their brilliance. And that's what it is. I'm inspired by this conversation. What do you think, Advita?
It's been incredibly fascinating to hear your perspective from the roles that you started from and where you are today, and the work that you're doing to keep driving this agenda forward. I think people underestimate how much energy and effort and time goes into developing a benchmark of this scale, and the work, not only from your side in terms of the leading the work, but also the contribution from the leaders around you. And Priya and I, you know, we face into conversations a lot with organizations who just don't know where to start, or what to say, or where to even go. And I think what you have done with this framework and benchmark is incredible. And I hope our listeners go and download the assessment and it contribute towards it, ask questions. We're all about the curiosity. You know, our book was started from a curious mindset, and we want others to evoke that curiosity so they can start making change happen. And to what Nini said before, you know, everybody has a responsibility in this, not only not only the dominant culture, regardless of where you're living and where you're working, it's everyone's responsibility to contribute to change. And I found this incredibly fascinating. And we'll make sure for our listeners that all the information that you need about the GDEIB benchmark is in our show notes. And if they did want to connect with all of you, where's the best place for them to do that?
We'll send you our emails and phone numbers. That's fine. Yeah.
Actually, it's on the, you already have it on the bio sketches and that sort of thing. So you can use those emails and phone numbers. And it would be best to contact either one of the, you know, either one of the three of us.
Okay, amazing. So we'll make sure that we share that in the show notes. But thank you to all three of you for this incredible conversation and for making this happen across four different time zones. We're extremely grateful.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. And good luck to you two, too.
Yeah. Thank you.
And everybody else that's listening to this podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to our A Leader Like Me podcast.
Find us on socials and at aleaderlikeme.com.
And please do read our new book, Building a Culture of Inclusivity, Effective Internal Communication for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. You can buy our book from anywhere you buy your books online.
And a discount code for our listeners is available. Just use the code ALLME20 at www.koganpage.com.
And please do reach out for us for any internal communication, change management, and DEI communication training and support your organization needs.
We have keynotes, workshops, and consulting programs available. Email us at info@aleaderlikeme.com.